Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. It's been nearly 6 months since Trump became president and over 7 months since George Polisner, an Oracle senior executive, publicly resigned from the company after his boss joined Trump's transition team, pledging her support to the president-elect. Since then, George has created a new website, CivWorks, a social networking platform centered around connecting those of us most interested in shaping America's future, a place for people across the political spectrum to move beyond petitions to take real steps towards change. This morning, George returns to Locus Focus to give us an update on his work with CivWorks and his take on the growing resistance to all things Trump. But first, we'll talk about the wide-flung network of billionaires that have been funding decades of efforts to create the political climate that now seizes the United States. George, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara. Thanks for having me on the show.
And it's always good to have you here. Well, we were talking the other day about the decades of efforts to build the kind of resistance to progressive change that we saw really flower in the last couple of years. And for people who woke up on November 9th amazed that there had been this right-wing coup taking over the United States government, actually, if they had been aware, which most people weren't, that this was not something that just happened in the course of a few months or even the year and a half of Trump's presidential campaign, but had really been started in the 70s. So I wanted to ask you, like, in your mind, what was maybe the pivotal document that really changed political discourse in this country?
Well, it's the anniversary is coming up. August 23rd, 1971 was the date that Lewis Powell published his memo, which was entitled Attack on the American Free Enterprise System. And it's most commonly referred to now as the Lewis Powell memo.
Excuse me, George, could you talk a little bit more into your telephone? Because we need to raise your voice a little bit.
Sure. Is this better, Barbara?
That's a lot better. Thanks.
Okay, good. Good. Yeah, I mean, the anniversary is upcoming, and it was August 23rd, 1971, that Lewis Powell authored a memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the memo was titled Attack on the American Free Enterprise System. And it's about a 34-page document that it really should be foundational reading for any of us that are progressive, liberal, involved in the resistance, and even others in the center that are, you know, very curious as to how we got to this point in the American experiment.
And so, what did Powell's? What were his points? I mean, I think you mentioned it was sort of like a unionization of corporate America.
It was. It's ironic in that if you read it, it could have easily been called CEOs and Investor Class Unite. The reason it's important is it's important to understand that in each election cycle, we're fighting harder, tooth and nails, for policies that I think most Americans, at least, you know, people that are well-informed and well-educated, would embrace, you know, health care for all that is delivered in a quality way and in a manner that people can afford, higher education without having to leverage your entire future as a young American through student loans and debt. These are fundamental issues that when we talk about the tagline "Making America Great," these are things that would actually allow America to reach its potential as a democratic beacon for the rest of the world. And so, this document really describes the machine, and that's probably the best way to characterize it. But this machine that is now driven largely by the GOP, on behalf of really the obscenely wealthy and the wealthy class in the United States. When we talk about the 1%, these are the people that have benefited from multiple generations of this machine, you know, first being designed and then growing.
Well, let's talk a bit about the mechanism of this machine. I think, first of all, one of the things that's really striking when you start to examine the right-wing billionaire leaders of this movement is to realize how they actually, how they took our ideas that were really marginalized fringe ideas back in the 40s and 50s and 60s and even early 70s and turned them into what now is this political movement that is at least epitomized by Donald Trump and that has a certain, at least maybe 25, 35% of Americans actually believe these things. And as you're saying, it's like some core beliefs like the right to health care, which actually was not an American belief until... it still probably isn't that even though I think a lot of people believe that we should have a decent healthcare system for everybody, it has not been embraced systemically throughout this country, even with Obamacare, but also with environmental protections, which did become real mainstream values, wages, fair, good workplace conditions, the 40-hour week, which is something that's gone down the tubes. So how was it that they were able to... chip away at core values of America and replace them with values that basically really only boost their own bottom line?
Well, from my perspective, and the document is really, it's genius. It's evil genius, but genius nevertheless. And what it talk, what it's basically an understanding, Barbara, that this is a long battle. This is not something that is, you know, they were not dealing with, you know, hey, it's 2018, next year, let's be prepared for that election and see what happens. They Lewis Powell was very farsighted and looked at this as it's going to be a generational thing. And so the types of things that he talked about is, first of all, he chided the CEOs, as well as the very wealthy, for really acquiescing to a movement of people. And this movement of people saw things occur in the 1960s, like Medicare and Medicaid were formed. The EPA, I believe, was born in 1970. The Voter Rights Act, the Higher Education Act, in which federal scholarships were made available to students. These are all things that came out of the 1960s and early 1970s. And so he basically said, look, the people are, this is very, very scary because the people are really questioning, you know, the materialism that I think is at the core of the American economic engine. You know, there are the civil rights movement joining with the labor movement, the anti-war movement, were starting to intersect. The women's movement, the formation of the National Organization for Women came out of this era. And so what Lewis Powell said and what he articulated is, first of all, he felt a major problem was in the colleges and academic community. If you read the document, as I really recommend all of the listeners do, is he was concerned that most political science, economists, sociologists, and historians teaching at America's schools had a liberal orientation, which I found kind of interesting because it's like, you know, hey, we have too many math teachers teaching 2 + 2 = 4. We need to get the other side. You know, I think that when you're well-educated and you understand how a great society should work, you know, you are going to essentially have some thought about, you know, how we all succeed together as opposed to just kind of a me-first, very, you know, selfish type of economic system and political system. So he initially identified colleges and the academic community as a problem. He looked at broadcast television and spoke about broadcast TV having 50 million viewers, but not really much representation of the conservative thought or conservative ideas. He was concerned that school textbooks were not subjected to review and could teach anything that they wanted. He felt that people like Ralph Nader and others had, you know, were often quoted in the media and were really promoting a view that was very anti-corporate power. And so he articulated all of these issues and laid out a guide as to what the conservative machine should look like. The document was very thorough. It extended to the courts. It extended to politicians. He, in the document, claimed that there was a stampede of politicians to support the environment, and he had the environment encapsulated in double quotes. It's just amazing when you look at that. It's almost like watching 2001, A Space Odyssey, and identifying all of the things that basically came true from that film. We see everything that was described by Lewis Powell in his 34-page memo as having been implemented and really well-funded and has grown in power and resources over the years. In fact, at one point in the document, when he's talking about academic freedom, he uses the phrase fairness and balance, which you have to wonder if Fox News, when they chose the tagline, the ironic tagline, fair and balanced, was a tip of the hat to the Powell memo from 1971.
And we might just add that Louis Powell was then appointed to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon. And
that's right.
It's interesting to me because I only came across references to the Powell memorandum in the last few months. I've read several books about the right, and I just finished reading Jane Mayer's excellent book, Dark Money. And and it's interesting to me how many places people are making references to it now, but I didn't hear about this 20, 25 years ago when I was doing a lot of work on the far right. So it's probably a good thing that we're starting to talk about this, but some of it I think is it's important to get back to the source of what has caused the kind of mess that we find ourselves in. And it's interesting to see that there was a document that laid it all out. Now, what was really critical to realizing Lewis Powell's dreams was having it financed. And probably most of our listeners know about the Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch, who've been funding right-wing causes for a long time, but might not realize, and this is something I learned from Jane Mayer's book, how they really grew on the shoulders of giants like Mellon and Scaife and actually the Bradley Foundation in Milwaukee, who were like funding right-wing causes before the Kochs even came along. So the Koch brothers started out being like these kind of fringe libertarians who were too far to the right for the Republican Party, but somehow they have merged with or found ways to change the tone, the branding of their ideas so that they become more acceptable to the mainstream. What's your sense of how they have made things acceptable, like basically the fact that what's good for their bottom line is good for America?
Well, you know, that's a great point, and another person that I really enjoy reading is Dr. George Lakoff, who is a linguist at Berkeley, and he deconstructs a lot of the political language and frame that's used by the right wing, and so, you know, this language, this use of language, you can look at it going back to when Ronald Reagan, and every time I say that name I throw up a little bit, but when Ronald Reagan talked about the Cadillac driving welfare queen. I mean, what he did was he established a frame of hate for the poor and people of color. He created this visual frame. And so what the conservatives have been very, very good at doing, and not pure conservatives, I mean, not certainly the Eisenhower conservatives, but these what I would consider to be extreme fundamentalists, they throw out the term free market, or even in the Powell memo, he talked about this as a free enterprise system, and it's promoted by people like Milton Friedman, the famous economist, or so self-proclaimed economist, that was really advancing the trickle-down economics that has led to massive wealth inequality and income inequality in America. But they use terms like free market, and free market is not only an innocuous sounding term. It sounds like, hey, that sounds like it would be a good thing. Who doesn't like, you know, shopping? Who doesn't like a market and free? That's you know, freedom, you know, free and this, you know, this visual frame of an American flag. But the reality is there is no free market. But they craft language and they craft visual frames that appeal to a lot of people. I mean, when, for example, I think George W. Bush and his terms created, I think, the Healthy Forests Initiative. And the Healthy Forests Initiative created this frame of, you know, hey, who doesn't like a healthy forest? I mean, we really appreciate that here in Oregon. The reality of the legislation and policy was opening up forests and national parks to, you know, mining interests and lumber interests and, you know, clear-cutting forests. And so they've done a great job. You know, part of this well-funded effort has been about, you know, what plays well from a language and advertising perspective. They're very good at what they do.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with George Polisner, who originally came to fame by resigning very publicly from Oracle after the CEO of Oracle joined Donald Trump's transition team back in December and proclaimed her allegiance to Donald Trump. So George, since then, has been, he's no longer working at Oracle, it's freed him up to be a full-time activist. Is that correct?
It has. I certainly have had the freedom of time. And I mean, you know, it's the kind of thing, Barbara, when you're, you know, I have to say I miss Oracle twice a month on former paydays. But nevertheless, I mean, you know, I think that I am shoulder to shoulder with so many really great people that I admire and respect. I'm very, very happy to be devoting my time and energy to establish a countervailing force, a societal force for people to fight against this massive, you know, wealth-funded machine.
Well, I was just thinking about your describing the kind of very benign or even appealing terms that the far right has come up with to brand really despicable ideas. And a friend of mine went off one day about natural gas and how, actually, I give him, this is Bill Bigelow, who I think is a really major thinker here in the Portland area in terms of education. But he was saying that whoever came up with the term natural gas was a brilliant genius in marketing, because you've taken this horrible poison, which is methane, and called it natural gas. Who could ever oppose natural gas until you're choking to death from it? And I think that in a way, that's really an excellent analogy for the Koch brothers, who, in fact, are fossil fuel magnates, among other things. But that one of the things that really jumped out at me when in reading Jane Mayer's book is that what the Koch brothers were really artful at was taking their clothing some pretty selfish and very self-oriented, self-interested ideas in the common good. And so it was the common good of libertarian, very extreme right-wing libertarian thought, which government is bad for people and is bad for poor people and industry is much better for them. But in fact, they were very specifically targeting environmental regulations that were affecting them, which were causing them massive fines and threatening to shut them down. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that contradiction, like the hypocrisy of what is being said by these people on the far right and their funders like the Koch brothers and Robert and Rebecca Mercer and all the other people like that, the conflict between what they're saying and what their real goals are.
Yeah, you know, I mean, part of the Powell effort and the funds that flowed into this machine were the creation of think tanks like the Heritage Foundation. Certainly the Koch brothers are around a couple of different think tanks like Americans for Prosperity and the Heartland Institute.
And by the way, they funded the Heritage Foundation initially.
Not only that, but I mean, when you look at, this has so many deep roots, and that's why I really implore people to look at it and study it, because ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that promotes legislation like Stand Your Ground, which, you know, the reality is it should be called Open Season on People of Color. ALEC has been, you know, there with respect to drafting legislation that protects big oil and the extraction industry. There is such deep integration between funding of think tanks, lobbying efforts, which is something that that is also called out in the Lewis Powell memo. The crafting language, and language is something that's so important to how we view the world or perceive the world around us. And so to your point, absolutely, you start thinking about things like clean coal, a happy meal, which is, if you're the animal involved in the process, it's certainly not a happy meal for you. Climate denial, and all of the funding that from Exxon, and Koch brothers and others that basically went into delaying any kind of societal response to climate change. The language is incredibly important. And when Dr. Lakoff talks about language, he often mentions Frank Luntz, who, from a right-wing perspective, is their language person, although I'm certain it extends well beyond Frank. These are, ads. This is what we would see in advertising and marketing, as you say. It is essentially putting a happy face, a happy Walmart face, on the front of a brightly lit store in which really horrible things are going on in the background.
Well, you talk about the incredible network of think tanks, arms reaching into academia. We didn't mention the media, but of course media, and particularly Fox News, is a really big part of this as well. And then all the lobbying efforts and advertising efforts. How do you see that is there a way for the left to be able to create the same kind of networks? Of which actually I think that Lewis Powell was accusing the left of having these networks back in the early 70s. But do you see that there's a way that we can build the same kind of structure or infrastructure actually to start to disseminate ideas that are actually good for people?
I think we have to think of it in a completely new way. And I think that unfortunately, in the progressive liberal community, we really think in very siloed ways. We're very passionate around very specific issues that we care about, and what we have dealt with over time, and what I'm trying to respond to with CivWorks, and I'm one of many different really great efforts that are occurring that all focus around the resistance or transformational politics. I'm working with some great people like Naomi Wolf at Daily Cloud and Stefan Seuss at Activism Engine and Britt Blazer at newgov.us and just a host of really amazing people. We can't approach this in the same way. And even if I think people have tried, but what we're not good at is looking at infrastructure that's required for a transformation. And what I mean by that is my observation in basically being involved in the progressive liberal space for many years is we have this science fair mentality in terms of how we resource things or how we fund things. And so everybody shows up at the science fair with a volcano, and we all look at the coolest volcano, and that's what basically attracts the resources and funding. Or if you think about it in a real estate development paradigm, everybody, unveils, an amazing looking building that they want to build, and the most amazing building gets funding. But people forget that there's a need for sidewalks and plumbing and electricity. It's all of that infrastructure that's required to support, something that is going to work for us. And so we see in the progressive liberal side, we talk about money being a problem in politics, and of course it is. But we see that there is a lot of money that flows into progressive liberal candidates and Democratic candidates, but it simply isn't, it is less effective because we haven't had that long-term thought about Well, what about the societal perspective in our textbooks? There was an effort, I think, in Kansas or somewhere in the Midwest to eviscerate AP history because it wasn't patriotic enough. And so, where are the progressive liberals? Where are we in funding efforts to make sure that what's being taught in schools is on the basis of academic freedom and isn't just specifically coming from the Koch brothers or the Focus on the Family and other religious organizations? We are attracted to candidates. But we are less, we find for whatever reason, this infrastructure that's required for long-term transformation to be, maybe we don't have the patience for it. Maybe the words that Martin Luther King said very eloquently always resonate in my head, the fierce urgency of now. And so I get that, but we have to understand that we are in a generational battle that won't be solved in 2018, and it won't be solved in 2020. This is something that requires all of us together and our energy and resources to think in new, long-term ways that start with the education system, just as Lewis Powell mentioned, new media. So, whereas a lot of Lewis Powell's focus was on TV, we really need to make use of new media, although I would say, we're sadly behind in that. When we look at what Robert Mercer was doing with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica in analyzing data and then being able to essentially send false news and propaganda out to people and groups that then, shared it repeatedly, we need to really have a understand new media and use it effectively. It's a host of things that we have to be doing. It can't just be about funding a special election and thinking that we're through that going to make the world a better place.
Well, there are some hopeful signs. I mean, I think that there are a couple things that have happened in Portland since Trump was elected that I feel very proud about and hopeful. And one was, like, right after the election, the Portland City Council voted to ban all future fossil fuel infrastructure in the city for mass storage of fossil fuels. And it was a real landmark decision, which got notice around the country, and it's becoming kind of a model for other communities to follow. And it's, even though it's being challenged by a bunch of right-wing fossil fuel groups at the state land use board, it looks like it's very solid legally and will hold up. Another thing that happened last spring was that a bunch of climate activists, climate activists, both teachers and parents and community members, got the Portland City, the Portland School Committee to vote in a curriculum that requires that the schools teach climate justice and that make sure that there are meaningful mentions and sections in curriculum about climate justice throughout the school system, and that there's funding to buy materials and to get appropriate textbooks that will be teaching this. So I see it happening spottily in certain communities. I guess the question is, how do we find the models? And one more thing I'm going to throw out, because as you mentioned about special elections, and of course my mind immediately goes to John Ossoff in Georgia and that failed attempt. But meanwhile, I've been hearing about all these local, like state-level special elections where Democrats are winning, and we're not hearing about that. So I'm wondering how we spread the good word about the things that are being done and help to build on that.
You know, you're absolutely right, and that's incredibly important, because In order to sustain a movement which really has to persist over a generation to make the kind of change, and maybe even multiple generations now that the Supreme Court has gone the way that it has gone, we have to be prepared for a long effort, and so understanding where we have victories, understanding those victories, and making sure that we add to our playbook, evolve the playbook over time, so we can continue to expand our footprint, is going to be really important. And certainly the significance of state and local government is not lost on me. I mean, I know that, and it certainly hasn't been lost on the Koch brothers or what we face, because at present, as you know, 31 out of 50 state legislatures are ultimately controlled by the right wing. And so where we're able to enjoy local law that will be supported by our state government in places like Denton, Texas, where the community voted and passed a bill banning fracking, that was the state legislature, obviously controlled by the right, passed a bill that fundamentally preempted local governments from passing laws about environmental protection and fracking specifically. And so we're fortunate here. We just need to export the Oregon model and our great governor, and out here in District 10, David Gomberg and Arnie Roblin, our state senator, and even all the way down to our local county commissioners, Bill Hall and Doug Hunt and Terry Thompson, we're very, very fortunate. But other state legislatures, as we know, I mean, we can see what's happening in Kansas. And Kansas, you know, when we think about free market economics, this trickle-down, you know, economics, Reaganomics or Trumpnomics, I think, as Trump is trying to call it, is really nothing more than a massive fraud that's perpetrated upon society by the very wealthy. And, you know, if people want to really understand trickle-down, what it means is I give my money to the Koch brothers, and then at some point I might get a job out of it. and so, you know, that makes no sense to me at all. And I'm really surprised that people feel that, or continue to feel that what we need are, you know, more tax cuts for the wealthy, because somehow that will solve wealth inequality. It's ludicrous.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with George Paulsner, who's a political activist out in Lincoln County here in Oregon. And he achieved a fair amount of notoriety last winter when he resigned very publicly from Oracle after the CEO of Oracle joined the Trump transition team. Well, before we get too excited about what's happening in Oregon, I just want to throw out the other side of it. Is I was looking at an analysis of the achievements and lack of achievements of the just recently ended legislative session here in Oregon. And there were some wonderful things that were passed, and there were some really wonderful things that never got to the floor, which is a big concern. And even though there's a lot more freedom in the state for local communities to pass progressive legislation like what's happening here in Portland, one area where I think the state really falls down is in controlling genetically engineered crops. And that's been a big issue, particularly in southern Oregon and in the South Willamette Valley. And a couple of years ago, the legislature basically passed a statewide law that preempted any kind of local control, local banning of growing GE crops. And this year, Our Family Farm from Jackson County was trying to get some legislation passed that would provide what they really see as a rational set of rules for controlling the spread of GE crops and protecting organic farmers and specialty crop farmers. Never got to the floor. So that's the other part of it, is I think we need to do even more here in Oregon to make sure that we don't stymie progressive local efforts at the state level, and that we push for more progressive state legislation that would, I mean, we didn't ever pass cap and trade. There's a whole lot of things that didn't happen. And it's frustrating to have like a supermajority of Democrats in the Senate and the House in Oregon and a Democratic governor, and we still can't do some basic things, or, for example, stop LNG in Coos County. So how do you see, I mean, as a Democratic Party activist out on the coast, how do you see pushing the party to be go beyond its rhetoric and actually get something done?
Well, that's a really good point, and as you were talking, my mind was going to the Senate President Peter Courtney and his killing national popular vote once again, which is very disconcerting to me, and I know a lot of people that worked on getting that bill passed.
Hey, let's just explain what that is.
So the if if all 50 states had basically adhered to a compact in which their electoral votes would be essentially would be counted toward the winner of the national popular vote. In this case, it was Hillary Clinton by more than 2.5 million votes. Then we would still be able to we would still follow the constitutional law related to the Electoral College. However, we would be electing the president on the basis of who received the most votes, as opposed to what happened to us in the United States in the year 2000, in which Gore should have really been our president instead of Bush being appointed by the Supreme Court. And certainly Hillary's very large victory over our tiny-handed, very corrupt, and perhaps treasonous president, she would have been our president. And so Oregon, there is a and I'm not sure of all of the states where it's now successfully passed, but I know the legislation was pending. There have been multiple attempts at passing the legislation here in Oregon that have been unfortunately killed by Senator Courtney.
What, you understand what his motivation is for killing that?
I can only think that it's to just raise my blood pressure, Barbara.
It's personal. It's always personal. I mean,
I don't know. I've never had a chance to talk to him or his staff about it. And you know, he's one of the members of our legislature that I really haven't had any chance to meet with or speak with. And so I simply don't know. I can say, in terms of what you were talking about, as far as hey, we had some good legislation pass, but there was a lot of stuff that was left on the table. And I can say, in you know, working fairly closely with some of the legislature, is that this was an incredibly challenging session from an economic perspective, because you're dealing with the competition for attention and resources with public education, higher education, transportation, and certainly the unfunded pension liability was hanging over, you know, Salem like a dark cloud. And so balancing all of the needs, and you know, some of us think, well, hey, we're growing economically now. The economy is stronger than. You know, thanks really to terms of President Obama, you know, why aren't we able to do these things? And the reality is, I mean, we dealt with economic retrenchment, you know, we multiple wars that were at a time, in an unprecedented time, in which the very wealthy received tax cuts, which and a lot of additional pressure, economic pressure moving from the federal government to state and local governments. And so we're still dealing with that. That's not something you can solve at once. And so, you know, there are multiple multiple legislative sessions and cycles that have to really very carefully address the economics of so many things that were left to erode and decay over the course of the first part of this century. And so you simply can't do everything at once. And I'm, you know, I know how hard David Gomberg works and others in the legislature, and so I do appreciate, you know, their efforts and what they're doing on behalf of all of us. And they face, I do know that they face an incredible amount of growing pressure, because when we talk about language and what the right wing does, the right wing is really now starting to characterize the legislature in Salem as, you know, Portland's legislature, that they've left the rural areas and counties behind, which simply isn't true. I mean, they are doing, I think, a very good job to balance the needs of the state, the needs of the people, but still provide enough space for intelligent economic growth and business growth. So it's not an easy thing, and And so, but to your point, we have a lot more work to do, and we do have to hold them accountable. I mean, it's up to all of us. We can't simply just vote and then go away. It's up to all of us to really stay involved in the process.
Well, now, for the last part of the show, I kind of talk about what you are doing to build that infrastructure that you were describing, the sidewalks and roads and power lines and all the other stuff you need to keep this development going. So let's talk a little bit about CivWorks and what your goals and your vision is for engaging more people, or let's say a critical mass of people, in the democracy movement.
So that's an excellent question, and I struggle with that question on a daily basis. What CivWorks, fundamentally, the way that I've described it before is that we try to essentially provide a very good social network experience. And so I've often said we're like Facebook, but not as good, and we charge for the experience. And then I usually get a lot of notes from my team that says I really shouldn't describe it like that, but. The reality is we don't have the hundreds of millions of dollars to put into the experience as somebody like a Facebook would. But what we're doing is we're providing a very similar social experience, but what we've also done is we've added some layers which really I believe will ultimately allow us to sustain the kind of civic engagement that I talk about. And so, for example, we're advertising free. We don't take any advertising or marketing money. We're a nonprofit. But what we do is, instead of advertising, we take civic actions. And so, for example, the ACLU may say, we need to respond to this bad policy, and so we need people to do this thing. Or, for example, just voting is an incredibly important civic action. Or understanding, maybe watching a 2-minute film on the techniques of voter suppression and why it's important. That is an expression of civic engagement. And so what we're doing is we're working to aggregate all of these actions. For example, when Ron Wyden comes to Lincoln County for a town hall, anybody that's subscribing on CivWorks that has a zip code in or near where Ron Wyden is going to speak, we will send a message out to everyone saying Ron Wyden is going to be here. Or, for example, this Thursday, David Gomberg is conducting a town hall in Newport, and so we would put that message out to our subscribers that are here in the Lincoln County area. So what we're doing is we're aggregating actions at a local, state, regional, and national level, and instead of bombarding people, instead of saying, hey, Barbara, here are 50 things you need to do before Monday, before you go to work on Monday morning or democracy is going to collapse. We provide, just very lightweight, hey, here's something you can do. You really are working with a network of people that are committed to remaining engaged in the civic process and really trying to strengthen democracy and trying to make America a better place. And then beyond that, there's been a lot of interest internationally to use a platform like CivWorks, which provides a social experience, but also provides the design and architecture for civic actions, which was built for us by an entity here in Portland called ARC Interactive. And they've done a phenomenal job, because I came to them with my concept not long after I resigned from Oracle in December, on December 20th, and we launched on February 14th. And so they took this vision and turned it into reality in a very short period of time. And then in terms of civic engagement and civic action, Naomi Wolf and I found each other, and Naomi was leading an effort to open up legislation to mere mortals like us. And so taking all of the federal and state legislation and allowing people to search on it and socially comment on it. And so I've been guiding on that effort, and we've been working together. And so it's really exciting. I mean, they're working together with local Indivisible organizations. We're collaborating and or conspiring, however you want to look at it, with a lot of great groups like Action Alliance and the Progressive Coders Network, Stephen Seuss, who we've been working with almost since the beginning, who has something called Activism Engine. All of these parts people don't have to know about, but they're all underneath the surface of, you know, this CivWorks concept, because ultimately what I want to do is to have societal flash mob capability when we need it to either resist bad legislation or to support good legislation and policy, like perhaps, you know, an actual living wage, or, you know, getting a national holiday as election day, or even better, you know, expanding vote by mail to every state, so you don't have the voter suppression efforts that are continuing under this administration, which to me are completely antithetical to any kind of thought of democracy.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with George Polisner, who is the director and founder of CivWorks, and he's just been describing it as, so it's sort of, you sort of describe it as a social network experience, and you made some mention to Facebook, but it sounds to me like it's really different from Facebook for a number of reasons, one being that Robert Mercer will not be trolling and getting all your information and sending you fake news, and another one being that it seems like it's more directed. So I'd like to, how is it like Facebook, and how is it different from Facebook?
Well, it's as different from Facebook as we can make it, because we don't want to have to talk to Mark's lawyers. and so, but you really, really captured it. I mean, when I do talk about CivWorks, I call it the social platform, the privacy-protected, ad-free social platform for civic engagement. And so it is similar in a lot of ways in the respect that we provide the mechanism for individuals to connect. So you're connecting with your friends and fellow activists and others. There is group functionality, just as there would be in Facebook. But we really make actions kind of the highest value content or central content to the platform. But you know, most of the things that you would do on Facebook, you can do on CivWorks. You can cross post. So in other words, you can update your status on CivWorks and automatically update your status to Facebook and Twitter if you so choose. But the important part of what you said is that we're privacy protected. So our subscribers, and subscribers pay $3.99 a month, and as part of that, they're really helping us build this. I mean, it's we don't take ad money. We haven't taken anybody's money. And so, you know, when I think about what we're building, this to me is a countervailing force. It's really a societal mechanism that we can use to effectively, you know, come together as a society and achieve nice things. You know, it's like, why can't we have nice things? It's really because of this massive right-wing machine that we face. And so this is really an attempt to bring a lot of ideas together in a very simple way for American society to really participate in the political process and to improve the quality and dignity of our lives and that of our communities and families. And so anyways, the data being private is exactly what you just said. We don't sell this data to marketers or advertisers, and certainly not to sinister political operatives that are going to try to get you to disengage from the political process or get your friends to disengage or vote against your own self-interest.
So how would people get involved with CivWorks?
So going to civ.works, W-O-R-K-S, and registering, signing up for the service. It's free for the academic community. So if you're, we didn't want to add to the student loan debt burden, and I've talked to enough adjunct professors who really don't make very much money. And so it's free to the .edu space, but the rest of us pay $3.99 a month and subscribe to CivWorks or, you know, help fund our work. And we're incredibly grateful for all of our subscribers. I mean, I like to think of us as being shoulder to shoulder, without regard to political ideology, working on really good societal outcomes so that we can we really can be a beacon of democracy and a showcase for the rest of the world.
Well, in the last few moments we have, I wanted to kind of change to a subject I just can't resist talking about. I just wanted to get your take on what's the latest Trump scandal and if you think this may be a tipping point.
it's hard to say exactly what will be the tipping point. We're in a very challenging, as we all know. I mean, this is a very challenging and largely unprecedented time because if I think that there were probably grounds to remove him from office, perhaps before he took the oath of office. But in any event, the collusion with a foreign government to subvert democracy, to me, seems like a fairly serious offense. And the family, I like to call them America's disorganized crime family, are so deeply involved in so many, and there are so many corrupting influences. But the problem that we face is waiting in the wings is the right-wing insurance policy, you know, Pence. It's hard to say. He certainly is not unscathed by the corruption and the scandals that are, you know, basically swirling around this executive branch. But nevertheless, do you remove Trump and then have, you know, somebody who's essentially an extreme right-wing Christian fundamentalist be president? And they equally scare me, Barbara.
Well, actually, I mean, my fantasy is that we buy enough time that the scandals are slowing down the Trump agenda for sure. And hopefully we can really just slow it down, which will help everything except climate change, which can't deal with the slowing down. But so that's part of it. While more and more comes out to the point where Pence is as
culpable
as anybody else, which it seems to me, it's kind of like, as Bill Maher says, you know, there's no proof, but I just know it's true. You know, it's like, so, I mean, unfortunately, we have to get the proof. But so that's my fantasy. And I'm hoping that there's enough that's going to keep unfolding. And then in the next while that he'll get caught in the snare and drag it out to 2018. But in the meantime, we have to build that infrastructure you're talking about. Otherwise, 2018 will come and go without any significant change.
Absolutely. The infrastructure needs to be built, and it needs to grow over time, because somebody on my advisory board who's you know, a great person is always challenging me, saying, so what difference will this make in 2018? And, you know, the reality is we're confronting something that was built and has been growing for 40 years. If we come together quickly, I mean, I think that we can certainly have an impact. But I'm really looking at, you know, as much resistance as we can provide over the next couple of years, while really building a transformative movement in this country to at least equalize power between people and wealth, as opposed to just runaway wealth as it has been for the last, you know, 20, 25 years. I think the best bumper sticker that I've seen around Oregon, and I don't know who's responsible for it, was I saw a Hillary 2017 bumper sticker. And I loved that.
Well, we only got about 6 more months left. We'll see. Well, George, it's always good to talk to you. So I look forward to our next conversation. I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Barbara. I appreciate your having me.
We've been talking this morning with George Paulsner, who's founder and director of CivWorks, a social platform for change, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, my guest is Emily Monison, who's author of Natural Defense, Enlisting Bugs and Germs to Protect Our Food and Health. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Pat Betsy Kohlberg. We're going to go out with some music by the Buffalo Springfield. Thanks for listening.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and a carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man comes.